You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, May 12th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, we are packed. First up, the great Ari Berman on the growing pushback, judicial pushback, against voter ID. And then on the program, Sabrina Joy Stevens from Integrity in Education on a new report showing that charter schools are also rife with fraud. On top of everything else, that's what you get when you privatize, folks. Job number one becomes profits. Also on the program today, conservatives freak out. Michael Sam, first openly gay player to be drafted by the NFL. What's the response? You're oppressing Christians. And speaking of oppressing Christians, we mentioned with Cliff I guess it was just Friday, about one of President Obama's picks for the federal judiciary, a guy named Michael Boggs. Now there's videotape out of a speech he gave on the floor of the Georgia legislature, bemoaning activist judges who would contravene Christian values.
There wasn't deliverance.
No, there was no theme music. Also, that Koch brothers AFP memo outlining the real problem with Americans, that they don't subscribe to what the Kochs believe. So we're going to have to spend more money. And the net neutrality fight heats up. Tom Wheeler, feeling that heat, coming out with a revised version of his plan to create a slow lane for all of us online. The big difference? He claims it will not create a slow lane for all of us online. Hard to believe. All right, we're going to take a break, folks. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ari Berman. We are back. Sam Steeter on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure, excuse me, to welcome back to the program the author of Herding Donkeys, I'm not sure what your official title is at The Nation. I hope by now you're like editor or publisher. Ari Berman. Hello, Ari.
Hey, Sam. How you doing?
I'm doing well. What is your official title at The Nation?
Contributing writer.
Well,
I think I'm too lazy to get a better title, so I just keep the one I have.
We'll work on that. We're working on that. I know you're also...
Maybe you can suggest a few things next time.
All right. I'll spitball with you a little bit about it. Now, I know you're working on a book about voting rights, too. When's that coming up?
Next year on the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act.
Terrific. All right. Well, you're constantly getting more and more, stories for that book. Last week, I believe it was. Was it last week or maybe just the end of the week before? Big news out of Wisconsin. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I think it was maybe 2 weeks ago, but a judge in Wisconsin struck down the state's voter ID law. And it was a really important decision, not just because Wisconsin is an important battleground state, but because of the breadth of the decision and how extensive it was. The judge really went through all the arguments for voter ID and debunked them. He noted that you had up to 10% of registered voters in Wisconsin didn't have the specific form of government-issued ID now required to vote. He showed how those people were disproportionately lower income and disproportionately black and Hispanic, so it had a discriminatory effect. He showed how getting an ID can be a very burdensome process, how you have to jump through multiple hoops from getting a birth certificate to getting other underlying documents to be able to get that supposedly free ID. And he basically said that there was absolutely no evidence of voter impersonation to justify the law, to justify the burdens of the law. Wisconsin didn't present basically any evidence to show why they needed a voter ID law that could potentially disenfranchise for no reason upwards of 300,000 people in the state.
Now, the reason why he found there was no evidence, they didn't even present any, right? I mean, I think common sense says that there is no less efficient way to attempt to, I guess, change the outcome of an election than to, I guess, presumably, I mean, I'm not even sure how it supposedly works, right? I mean, I guess the idea is that you get a bunch of people who would not normally vote in an election, right? I mean, it's like busloads of illegal immigrants. You find the voter rolls, the registration rolls of people who are dead, but are still registered. And then you pay each one of those to go in and pretend they're that person. Is that basically, I mean, I don't understand how voter fraud, I understand how voter registration can be, there can be, you know, people can sign up and they're not really eligible, but actual voter fraud, what is the theory on how that happens?
Well, the judge in Wisconsin said that it was an extraordinarily stupid way to try to steal an election because, as you mentioned, it's very complicated to do. And, you know, there's penalties for doing it, very strict penalties for doing it if you get caught. It's a lot easier, for example, to rig an election via absentee ballots, for example, than it is to actually show up at the polls and say, I'm Sam Sater, and then if you show up and you vote and you have proof of address and all that stuff, then they're going to know that I voted illegally as you. So why would I do that? And so the whole irony of this, the GOP's voter fraud crusade, is they're requiring this ID at the polls, but they're not doing anything about absentee ballot fraud, where that's actually much more likely to occur. And the reason they're doing that is because elderly people and the military are more likely to vote absentee. So they want to keep that going, whereas they know that in terms of voter ID, the people that don't have it, they're predominantly lower income, and they're black and Hispanic. And so it wasn't like all of a sudden the GOP found out the data on voter ID laws was discriminatory. I mean, they knew this from the very beginning. If you look at where these voter ID laws originated, I mean, they originated in Indiana and Georgia, two states where I think Republicans were very concerned about larger minority turnout in big urban areas, and that's what motivated the laws back then, and that's certainly what's motivated the laws after the election of Barack Obama, when you saw these laws start popping up all across the map.
And so now let me just offer this theory, okay? What they could do is, to keep me from actually voting, is they could call me and say, we need you out in Los Angeles during election day, and we're going to pay for you to fly out there because you're going to give a talk somewhere. And then they could send in somebody else to vote in my stead because I didn't have time to get in. I mean, that's the thing. It's just ridiculous. I mean, it's almost it's virtually impossible to do this on any type of scale that would impact an election. All right. So with that finding in Wisconsin, why is that one different from, say, the 2008 case where Indiana's voter ID law was upheld by the Supreme Court? What are the differences there, and what are the implications of this Wisconsin ruling relative to all the contesting of these voter ID laws?
So the Supreme Court, as you mentioned, upheld Indiana's voter ID law in 2008. I talk a little bit about this, about why, in a blog that I wrote today at The Nation. But basically, it was a decision that was authored, interestingly enough, by John Paul Stevens, who was definitely at the time on the court's liberal wing. And what Stevens basically said in his opinion was that Indiana, like Wisconsin, didn't present any evidence of voter impersonation. But what Stephen said is that they could take steps to basically ensure that elections were conducted fairly, and that justified the burdens of the law. Now, the thing is, in 2008, the justices didn't really know what the burdens of voter ID would be because there were no voter ID laws in effect at the time. And so Stevens subsequently in 2013 basically admitted that the burdens of voter ID were much more serious than he believed, that there were far more lower income people, minorities, elderly, disabled voters that either didn't have the ID or would have a hard time getting the ID. And so I think Stevens is an example of someone who's shifted on the issue. Now, the difference in Wisconsin was, number one, it was the lawsuit was under different terms. So the lawsuit in the Wisconsin case was under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. So it was actually a discrimination claim that the ID law was discriminatory. The courts didn't have to deal with that in Indiana. And we also just know a lot more about voter ID laws. Now, we know a lot more about the effect. There's more case studies. There's more of an analysis of the burdens versus justifications. And so I think the whole, both the how the law was challenged and the context of the law have changed considerably since that 2008 decision. That said, I mean, this could go back to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court could very well strike down the Wisconsin decision. The Court of Appeals could also strike down the Wisconsin decision. So this could be a temporary victory, no doubt about it. But the opinion itself will stand, I think, and be replicated in other cases, because it's not the first time a voter ID law has been struck down in court. This is the fifth time it's happened now.
But this is the first time it's been done under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
Yes, which is really significant, because Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act hasn't been gutted by the Supreme Court yet. And so it retains some power, but also we could then see claims against voter ID brought based on discriminatory purposes.
So explain to us, just, I mean, what does Section 2 say? And so why was this a... tell us what it said, and I guess we'll glean from that why it was more effective. I mean, aside from the data issue, which I want to come back to in a second, but so what does Section 2 say? So what does it affect the burdens? I mean, what is involved in that?
So Section 2 was basically written by Congress to mimic the language of the 15th Amendment, and it turned into a vehicle by which people challenge vote dilution cases. So let's say you have a city council in New York and it's all white, even though you have a very large minority population. People could bring a Section 2 suit and they could say, hey, this is diluting black voting rights because the city is whatever, you know, 30% minority, but there's not, you know, any minority representation. And thus, we should either change the system of government to make it so that minorities have an opportunity to elect a candidate of their choice. So really, that's how Section 2 originated. And basically, over the years, the Supreme Court has essentially created a test to see whether a mode of government has a discriminatory effect. And so there's a bunch of factors you have to show. And essentially, it's known as what's called the totality of circumstances. So you essentially have to show that the totality of circumstances in a given place has the effect of preventing minorities from being able to elect a candidate of their choice. Now, so as I mentioned, it's primarily been used in redistricting cases. It hasn't been used to challenge things like voter ID, which are relatively new, thought of as second-generation barriers to the ballot box. Well, you're not talking about actually denying representation. You're actually talking about denying someone's actual right to vote. And so basically the court has to look at these same circumstances, but then they have to say, do all these circumstances result in the kind of predominance of evidence that this thing is going to be discriminatory? Now, Section 2 cases are hard to win because usually you have to have data of their impact on the books. You have to be able to look at, for example, an election system and show that it's discriminatory. So it's hard to challenge laws like voter ID laws when they're not in effect yet because you don't have that data. The second thing about Section 2 is the burden of proof is on the plaintiffs to show that there is discrimination, which is a hard standard to win legally. So for that reason, there hasn't been a whole lot of Section 2 lawsuits about things like voter ID. They were more under, in select states, like under Section 5. And Section 5 is a provision that only applied to certain states with a history of discrimination dating back to the 60s and 70s. But in Section 5, these states had to preclear their voting changes with the federal government, and the burden of proof was on them to show that their voting laws were not discriminatory. So, for example, in Texas, when the federal court struck down Texas's voter ID law in 2012, Texas had the burden of proof to show that their voter ID law was not discriminatory, whereas in Wisconsin, the plaintiffs there, the ACLU and other groups, they had to prove that the voting law was discriminatory. So that's a big legal shift.
Now, had Wisconsin operated under this law, or was the data that they used to prove to basically clear that hurdle, that Section 2 hurdle, was that basically modeling or just simply showing data on how many people didn't have IDs? In other words, they didn't have real world data.
Well, they had statistical evidence of people who didn't have ID, and then they had real world data of troubles that people had obtaining the ID. So they had a number of people testify, a lot of senior citizens who had a hard time getting to the DMV or had a hard time obtaining a birth certificate, who had to go through multiple steps in this process, having essentially voted legally for 50 years now, some of them even longer, they suddenly had to go through this whole bureaucracy for no good reason. And so there were some real-world examples, but the law has been blocked in Wisconsin from the beginning because it was permanently blocked. It was temporarily blocked last year, and now it's permanently blocked. And so I guess what the court is saying here is that you don't necessarily have to have a law that's in effect to be able to challenge something. You just have to be able to have some good data on what it does and hopefully some examples of what will happen under it.
And that's really why it's so huge, right? Because you can now go, and if you want to challenge other voter ID laws in other states, you now have essentially the formula to cross that bar, at least as determined by this federal court in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I don't think it's going to be a one-size-fits-all thing, though. I mean, you know, Indiana was able to present pretty compelling evidence to the court, at least, that most people either had ID in the state or that they would be able to get ID. Now, states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania have really struggled to show that because we know that there are a large number of registered voters who don't have ID. I mean, it's basically 10% in both Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, and we know that the state has done very little to get them those IDs. Pennsylvania, I think, it only issued a few thousand of the supposedly free IDs when, you know, hundreds of thousands of voters didn't have them. So just a huge discrepancy between what the state said it was doing and, you know, what they were actually doing. And one of the problems with voter ID laws is that the burden is on the voter, not the state, to make sure that people have ID. And so, you know, if we were to implement some sort of voter ID system where the government said, we're going to make sure that an ID card is mailed to every eligible voter and et cetera, et cetera. I don't think we need that system, but it would certainly be more palatable than a system that basically says to voters, hey, you're on your own now to navigate a requirement that's never been needed before, and to figure out how it works and to make sure that you have it, when we know that the people that don't have it are disproportionately likely to be of one segment of the society and also are, generally speaking, more disadvantaged and have a harder time getting this access than other people would.
So what other cases are there other places where the voter ID is being challenged around the state? What's basically the scorecard here?
Well, the two big ones are Texas and North Carolina right now, and these are big Section 2 cases where the federal government has intervened, and there's a lot of legal firepower on both sides. And Texas is a situation where the law has already been found to be discriminatory by a federal court under a different provision of the Voting Rights Act, but once the Supreme Court gutted Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, a law that was judged to be discriminatory in Texas immediately went into effect. And so that's now being challenged after the fact in federal court. Same thing with North Carolina, where North Carolina would have had to clear their voting changes. They conveniently passed this sweeping of voting restriction package a month after the Supreme Court's decision gutting the Voting Rights Act, so they didn't have to submit their voting changes, so now their law is going into effect. Their voter ID law isn't going into effect till 2016, but other changes in the state, like cutting early voting, eliminating same-day registration, that's going into effect in this election. And so I think those are the two big states that everyone's looking at to see just how the courts are going to interpret this. Now, remember, we're talking about individual judges at this point in time.
Right.
One judge can say one thing and can easily get overruled by the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. So I think right now the momentum is certainly good in terms of the courts looking skeptically at these laws, but I'm under no illusions that might change. I mean, the courts could definitely, without Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, the courts could reach a very different conclusion very quickly here.
And so, and will we see other plaintiffs using or attempting to use Section 2 to challenge things like early voting?
Well, we've already seen that in Ohio. I mean, so right after the Wisconsin decision, the ACLU, who won in Wisconsin, they then challenged early voting cuts in Ohio, basically saying that in Ohio they had data that 157,000 people used early voting during the days and hours that were cut by the Ohio legislature and by the Secretary of State there. So what they did in Ohio is they cut the first week of early voting when you could also show up and register. So that was the only week you had same-day registration in the state. They got rid of that. Then they also, the Secretary of State in a directive, eliminated early voting on nights, and eliminated early voting on Sundays, and eliminated early voting 2 days before the election. So basically, the most convenient times for voting were eliminated by the state. And so that's being challenged in Ohio because there's very good data that blacks were far more likely to use early voting than whites. In Cleveland, for example, in 2008, blacks used early voting at a rate 20 times greater than whites. I was in Ohio for 2012 and in Cleveland as well in Cuyahoga County, and I didn't do a person-by-person statistical analysis, but I can tell you that I think three-fourths of the people who were using early voting there right before the election were African American. And so I think this is going to be a very interesting decision to look at how the courts interpret the Voting Rights Act in this context, because I think there's never been a Section 2 case that eliminated something like early voting.
Now, I assume in Wisconsin they're appealing this, right? This isn't one of those situations where Walker is like, well, I guess I had no idea that we were going to disenfranchise African American voters, so we should let this one slide. No, they're going to appeal, right?
Of course, and you know, Scott Walker and the Republicans there, they've been on a voter fraud crusade for years now. I mean, basically, Wisconsin's a state that's had been going bluer and bluer in presidential elections. And every presidential election, there's very high turnout in cities like Milwaukee and Madison. And every single year, Republicans allege that there is voter fraud in Milwaukee because there's essentially too large of a black turnout there. And so this is something they've been banging at least since 2004. And so they're not going to let this slide without a fight. I mean, Scott Walker even said he was going to call a special legislative session to address voter ID. He's not doing that now, but yeah, they're definitely going to appeal the ruling.
And we should remind people that this stuff really started, it seems to me, during those days when the Bush administration was looking for their U.S. attorneys from the Justice Department in each state to be pushing these theories that there's this massive voter fraud, right? I mean, that was one of the big scandals of the politicization of those U.S. attorneys. That was almost like the litmus test. Like, you got to go out there and say there's voter fraud so that we can start this ball rolling.
Well, the Bush administration, once they got into office, launched this major investigation into voter fraud. They didn't come up with many examples of voter fraud, but then they leaned on these U.S. attorneys to say that, yeah, you have to prosecute these cases. And the U.S. attorneys basically said, there's no evidence of voter fraud that we can prosecute. And then they were fired for it. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that I'm researching for my book, but it's definitely true that the whole hysteria over voter fraud really began in the Bush administration. I mean, you had previous administrations, the Nixon administration, the Reagan administration, that did not have particularly good records on civil rights. But they never made these crazy claims about voter fraud that we started to see in the last decade. And so this is definitely, I think, a phenomenon of Karl Rove-style politics really taking over the Republican Party.
All right. But now, with that said, you had a piece up today talking about how Rand Paul is coming out against these voter ID laws. What's going on there? I mean, I have a good guess, but you tell me.
Well, I think there's two things that are going on. I mean, part of it is political. I mean, Rand Paul's been talking about wanting to, you know, reach out to new constituencies and actually seems to be at times proposing policies that might appeal to those constituencies. I also think there's a libertarian aspect here. Rand Paul's been a critic of the drug war and things like that. And so he's been pushing, for example, for voting rights for nonviolent ex-felons, which I think is very significant. That's something that disenfranchises in certain states a lot of people who otherwise would be able to vote. He's criticized the GOP for cutting early voting. He said that they've overemphasized voter fraud. His latest thing is that he said that he was in Memphis meeting with black pastors, and he said that basically voter ID laws are a mistake because they're offending people. Now, I don't think that's the main problem with voter ID laws. The main problem with voter ID laws is that they're discriminatory and they're creating a burden for a justification that isn't real. But the fact that he's even suggesting that the GOP lay off something like voter fraud is a radical proposition in the Republican Party, where essentially you have all the major frontrunners for the GOP nomination who either are pushing these things or are certainly strongly supporting them. People like in 2012, you had Rick Perry and all these people talking about the need for voter ID. So Paul at least is pushing back on some of this stuff and on some issues like felon disenfranchisement. He's actually very good.
I mean, I may be a little bit more jaundiced and cynical than you because you're so significantly, I'm so much older than you are, Ari. But it seems to me
much more life experience.
Yes, yes. It seems to me this is a classic case of getting his cake and eating it too. You know, I mean, I don't think this is as much about him trying to reach out to those constituencies, to African Americans, to minorities, as much as it is reaching out to people who might support him, but for the fact that he has this perception because he's against things like the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, proving that he's like, it's like compassionate conservatism, right? Like, I'm not really going to do anything, but I want you to know that it shouldn't offend your sensibilities to support me.
Well, I'm not endorsing Rand Paul's policy platform across the board. I'm just saying, if you look at his work on felon disenfranchisement, he's stuck his neck out on that issue, okay? And he's actually testified in Kentucky in favor of it, and he's put his name on bills with people like Eric Holder. And so I think that's something that he actually believes in. I mean, it's hard to know, but I he certainly seems sincere on that issue. On other stuff, I mean, I think he definitely believes that this is hurting the Republican Party, that pushing for voter ID, cutting early voting, railing about voter fraud. I mean, I think, you know, these are things that he believes are certainly hurting the Republican Party. And I've been writing for a while now that Republicans used to be very strong supporters of voting rights. Not all Republicans, but certainly there was always a core constituency of Midwestern and Northern Republicans that played vital roles, both in terms of the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 and all the subsequent reauthorizations. And people don't realize that the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized four times, in 1970, 1975, 1982, and 2006. And every single bill was signed by a Republican president here. So even if the presidents didn't like voting rights, I don't think Bush or Reagan really cared for the Voting Rights Act, but they still had to sign the bill because there was such a congressional consensus behind that. And that's really changed. And so I think it's significant when people like Rand Paul come out at least partially in defense of voting rights. I'm not going to say that they're perfect on the issue. I'm not going to say why they're doing it. But I do think they have to get credit for doing this, because so few Republicans are doing this right now.
We just got a couple of minutes, but why do you think it's changed so much? I mean, you know, like you say, the Voting Rights Act was overwhelmingly reauthorized just 8 years ago. What Scalia said, like, they really wanted to vote against it, but they couldn't because they were afraid of being seen as racist. And I mean, what is it, just Rush Limbaugh essentially? I mean, I use Scalia and Limbaugh almost interchangeably now. They just show up at a different place to work every day, but it seems to me they have this similar perspective on things.
Well, I think it was Obama that did it. I mean, I think that the Republicans' whole philosophy about voting changed, that they basically saw Obama win with a very large turnout, particularly a very large turnout of young Black Hispanic voters, and they said to themselves, if this continues, we're through as a party because of the demographic changes in the country. So they started thinking about ways to manipulate the political process to make the electorate older, wider, and more conservative. They've done this through gerrymandering, and now they're trying to do it through administrative changes to voting as well. And they didn't like the fact that the Voting Rights Act was stopping these changes in places like Texas and North Carolina. And so I think the whole shift of the Republican Party, when they started embracing things like voter ID, cutting early voting, eliminating same-day registration, all of these things that they either were for or never really taken a position on, they weren't going to be for the Voting Rights Act, which stopped these changes as well. And so I think some of it was shifting, certainly in the Bush years, as you mentioned. But I think Obama was really the tipping point where Republicans seem to almost across the board abandon their support for voting rights.
Ari Berman, the soon-to-be promoted contributing writer at The Nation magazine and author
last
of Hurting
interview. Dogs. It's a guaranteed.
This is almost this is almost locked in. You should start to order that new desk sign that you have right now. I would suggest it.
If I keep coming on your show, I mean, I'll certainly be, you know, a billionaire by the end of the decade.
Well, I'm not sure there's actually going to be financial compensation that's going to come along with that promotion, but we'll work on it. Ari Berman, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Sam. I appreciate it.
All right.
Bye.
We're going to take a quick break, folks, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Sabrina Joy Stevens. She's the Executive Director of Integrity in Education. They came out with a new report on charters nationwide, just in time for a House bill that's passed that is another big giveaway to, it's just another form of privatization. We'll be right back after this.
Everybody's coming home for love.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Sabrina Joy Stevens. She's the Executive Director of Integrity in Education. They have just come out with a report this week in conjunction with the Center for Popular Democracy about what's going on in about, I guess it's 15 states or I guess 14 states and the District of Columbia regarding monies that are paid, public money that are paid to private schools, i.e. charters, and where a good chunk of that money ends up. Welcome to the program, Sabrina.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. So tell us, just give us the scope of this study and what you found.
Well, basically what we found was just an incredible amount of fraud and waste. So we saw a number of cases where, for example, money that had been set aside for, you know, for the normal, you know, running of a school, for things like school supplies, lunches, that instead people had decided to use on vacations and upgrading their houses and strip club trips even. And so, you know, it really points to how the charter school,
I got to say, that sounds educational, right? I mean, all of it.
Educational. It should be educational for the rest of society, you know, in terms of teaching us what happens when you don't regulate people. But, it, you know, so far it seems like at least the lesson's been lost on Congress.
So, I mean, so the people understand generally how charters work. They are basically get public funds, but without any of the oversight.
Right. So they receive public funds, but they are privately run, and there are very few proactive rules in place to make sure that these are competent individuals who are running these schools. So in the public school system, you're required to have background checks. You're required to meet certain qualifications in order to be a teacher or a principal, et cetera. Whereas in the charter sector, there aren't those same requirements necessarily. And so what we've seen is that, you know, a lot of the money that was lost beyond just the fraud and the abuse was also just waste from people who really probably weren't qualified to begin with and shouldn't have had access to this funding, but got it anyway because there's no proactive system in place to weed out these kinds of people.
So give us a sense. I mean, so you looked at 14 states and the District of Columbia. What, how did you go about getting this data? I mean, there doesn't seem to me to be any, I mean, you don't even have a central clearinghouse, it seems to me, within the states, never mind one-third of the states.
Right, and that was what made this so difficult to begin with, was that we basically had to rely on news reports, on criminal complaints and things of that nature in order to get at this information, because there isn't a central clearinghouse where you can find this sort of thing. So that's, you know, that's exactly part of the problem. We really don't even know the full extent of this issue precisely because we basically have a NOM system in place that depends on either whistleblowing media professionals or whistleblowers within the schools themselves to say something and then for it to be discovered. So it's not necessarily the case that these schools are regularly audited. It's not necessarily the case that there is a general office that is tasked with overseeing this, so that we can really understand what's going on in these schools. And that's exactly why we're calling for the reform that we're calling for, is because we shouldn't have to rely on, you know, whether or not a reporter even gets wind of something in order to have any kind of stewardship over our public money.
All right, so tell us specifically what kind of reforms you're looking at. Now, in New York State, this past budget, there was basically a trade-off that public education systems have to either guarantee placement within public schools, existing public schools for these more or less private schools, or they have to pay rent for these schools to find a location. But there is an increased oversight. I mean, in the past, we've had the state comptroller getting sued for just wanting to know how these charter schools are paying for things. The reform that you're proposing, what is it relative to what's now supposedly law of the land in New York?
Well, so what we're proposing is a much more comprehensive type of reform. So first and foremost, we want to make sure that the communities are actually controlling these schools. We have to keep in mind that this was charters were never meant to be an industry, and they certainly weren't meant to be a growth industry. They were supposed to be a small, you know, kind of controlled experiment, if you will, within the public school system that was meant to benefit the rest of the school system and students as a whole. And so what we want to see is kind of a system of oversight that actually reflects that. And so what we're talking about is making sure that communities are the ones who are governing these schools, that they aren't, you know, walling themselves off from the community and being able to give these kinds of perks to their owners, et cetera. So we're looking for more transparency, for more oversight, more community control, because that's how you weed out these kinds of problems. So the New York, you know, law is a little bit of a step in the right direction, but it really needs to go a lot further in order to really get at the problem here, the root problem.
And I will say that, you know, there was a story, I think it was today, or yes, Sunday, in the New York Daily News about a charter school paying essentially a middleman. Do you know this story? Because tell us about the story, because this is amazing. Because what? And then I want to know whether or not this would even constitute, even make the bar within the context of your research. Because you know, we can talk about fraud, but we could the problem with having these schools is that their business is to create profit for somebody.
Right.
And so
right.
That in and of itself to me seems like a huge waste, even if it's not fits the definition of what we perceive as waste.
Exactly. And I think that's another really important point that needs to be made here, is that this is not, you know, the school system is not supposed to operate for profit for a few people. It's supposed to be a public service that is for the general good of everyone. And so when you have this, you know, marketplace that's opening up that exists really to generate profit for individuals, that to me is itself corrupt. It may not meet the current definitions of fraud and abuse, but I believe that that is an abuse in itself, because there's no extra money in our public school system right now. I've yet to meet a PTA mom who says, oh, we can, you know, whatever extra money we raise, the kids don't need new instruments, let's give it to some CEO. Like, there's no extra money right now. And so anything that we have should be reinvested in the education of children. And when it's not, that's a problem.
This story out of New York is about a school called Brooklyn Dreams. They pay a for-profit firm, the National Heritage Academy's, firm, essentially, to find a space for them, even if Brooklyn Dreams paid the top rate that is paid for rent at the location they found, they're still spending an extra $1 million on top of that just to pay this middleman to find the location, which is just a matter of driving around and finding it. I mean, this sounds like a scam to me.
Exactly. And that's another key point about what's going on in the charter industry, which is that there are a number of things that really, by any standard appraisal, are scams, but aren't defined as such. There's not necessarily, there are things that are, for example, illegal for public schools that aren't illegal for charter schools. But there are also just a number of ways in which a lot of people have found opportunities to make money off of the public that the, you know, that lawmakers and that the rest of us are just not keeping up with. And so we're really getting grifted.
Yeah, and I should remind people that when I say that they're spending this extra $1 million, that's our money. That's money that's being taken out of the Department of Education budget that is simply going to a middleman that is not necessary in this process. And now New York City, at the very least, is obligated to pay for this money, but really has no control over how it's spent. I mean, the best case scenario is that we would just become more aware of this. We don't have to wait for an investigative reporter to do this. But again, you've got all these people who are making so much profit off it that it's hard to imagine it's going to go away unless there's some type of wholesale change. Now, also, tell me about the this. I don't believe it's going to become law, but this H.R. 10, what is that law that's passed Congress now, at least?
Well, basically, it's a $300 million giveaway to this industry. We just had, you know, a few brave lawmakers stood up and actually said, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. Why should we be giving $300 million more dollars to this industry when we just learned this week that at least $100 million has been lost to fraud and abuse? But so what we have is that they're incentivizing some of the worst aspects of the industry. So we already established, and this is agreed upon on both sides, whether you're a charter advocate or opponent, most people agree that there is not enough regulation and oversight. Yet they're giving incentives to states that lift their charter caps but don't have them already, so further encouraging expansion where there is already so little regulatory foundation. They're incentivizing the idea of basically the people who have the strongest protections are kind of getting the short end of the stick here, because it's the whole point of the bill is to encourage more growth. And again, that's not the point of this idea. Any merit that the charter school idea has, it comes from this idea that it's supposed to be a controlled experiment on the for the benefit of all public schools. They're incentivizing this idea of, you know, expanding just for the sake of charter growth, and it's not helping anyone.
Right. And when we say charter growth, we're basically talking privatization of our public school system.
Absolutely. We're talking about people who are making money off of schools, not necessarily people who are educating children.
Sabrina, has anybody done any studies on the effectiveness of the charter school? I'm not talking about in terms of educational outcomes. We know that all the studies show that there are some good charter schools, there are some really bad charter schools, and in the aggregate, public schools do slightly better if you look at the aggregate. But I'm curious, has anybody done any studies about the charter schools as experiments? In other words, what has come out of these labs that have fundamentally helped our broader education system?
Well, so far there haven't really been systematic studies of that, but there's just, you know, just today there's in the New York Times this article that's talking exactly about that, which is that even though that was the original idea, pretty much everybody agrees that there hasn't been a whole lot of cross-sector sharing. And that makes sense because, number one, the idea that you would pit schools against each other doesn't exactly create the conditions for collaboration. But the other thing, too, that has to be kept in mind is that just because something is new doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be better. And especially when you put new schools and old schools in an environment where everything is about high-stakes testing, it's really going to be hard for any kind of school, whether it's public or charter, to really be innovative. Everybody's going to be worried about whether or not they score well on these tests, and then that's what you're going to get more of, is schooling that, you know, that encourages kids to do well on tests and maybe doesn't do very much for them outside of that.
And with this lack of oversight and the lack of an ability of sort of really auditing what's going on in these publicly funded private schools, I mean, do we have a sense of what the budgets of these schools are? I mean, I know that in New York, I think it was last week, the Success Academies raised $7 or $8 million from a lot of Wall Street people. That's all well and good. We're still subsidizing those schools, obviously.
Right.
But I'm curious as to, has anybody broken down what the budgets are for these schools? Because I know that in looking at public schools for my kid, that if you go to a school that has a PTA, let's say, or a parents association that is raising hundreds of thousands of dollars, that tends to be a better school because they have more resources. Not every
Absolutely.
Neighborhood has the ability to do that. So, you know, if Success Academies is providing good test scores because they have a budget that may be twice the size of another elementary school, publicly funded and publicly audited and controlled elementary school, then that should come as no surprise, and that's something that is not scalable in any way.
Right, and that's the other piece that makes it very hard to even make the claim that it's an apples-to-apples comparison between charters and public schools. Because, yes, there's a lot of, you know, there are many schools that can command significant outside funding. So there's a lot, you know, there's the Charter School Growth Fund. There's all these different entities that exist purely to direct more money to these schools. And so while there's this really insidious and disingenuous campaign going on to call for charter school funding equity because they don't get the same amount of money as public schools, the fact is that they often end up outspending these schools. There is one study I'm aware of that was done by Bruce Baker, who's a school funding expert out of Rutgers. And he looks at kind of, you know, what is this bargain? Because there's a lot of people who believe in this original theoretical idea that maybe they can do more for less. And we should see if somebody is able to do that. And what it finds is that actually charter schools tend to do less with more. So these are schools that are serving less needy children, fewer students with special needs. They're serving students who tend to be less poor than their public school counterparts. And yet they have more money because of this private philanthropy that supports them. And so that's kind of, that's what we know right now about the sort of comparison between the two.
Well, Sabrina Joy Stevens from Integrity in Education, we're going to link to the study that you guys did. I really appreciate your coming on and talking about it and sharing it with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program, wherein we'll have the immense pleasure and fun of listening to Michael Boggs, the guy that President Obama has nominated to sit on the federal judiciary. We will get a chance to, it'll be Throwback Monday, to hear him on the floor of the Georgia state legislature talking about activist judges and how it's just commonsensical to follow these Christian conservative values. Also, speaking of funny, Marco Rubio, who is not a scientist, man, apparently is now a scientist, man. We will listen to that sound as well. We will also do a random Rush, because I would imagine Rush has spent the first hour of his program just beside himself at the chickification of the NFL. And pretty soon they'll be going around with pink helmets. Why? And then I'm sure there's going to be a healthy dose of, like, Tim Tebow, much maligned because of his Christianity. Yet Michael Sam could be all as gay as he wants to be. We probably don't even need to do Random Rush now. I think I just...
Why wasn't Tim Tebow allowed to make out with Jesus on ESPN?
That's right.
You just did it with a lot fewer pauses.
That's right. I just blew through that as well. We will also catch you up on net neutrality. We will take your phone calls, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. Also, you can IM me at Majority FM. Folks, this show exists only because of our members and continues to exist only because of our members. If all our members tomorrow decided that they could not no longer afford to support the program, the show would not exist after Friday. Like, for a day, we'd come in, we'd probably talk about how we have to clean up the office, then we have to see if I can get out of the lease, and Matt and Michael would say, well, can we hang out here and just party in the office? And I would say no. And we would spend, half a day carting out all of Matt's empty power drink bottles that he seems to leave around some type of very strange, I don't know. I think there's like a psychological disorder involved in that. You don't want to throw out it, like hoarding all those cans. But
there is, actual.
Here's the point, though, folks. They're all worth a nickel, but you never return them, right? You end up just... So we need your support, and you can become a member today at majority.fm. Become a member. It's only pennies a day. If you do not have the financial wherewithal and you want access to the extra 50 minutes that we give you almost every day, some days it's longer, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We're always behind on our emails, so bear with us in that respect. Also, you can support this program if you buy crap from Amazon. Certainly buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. You will notice no difference. We will get a spring in our step. Just head over there, click on the Amazon button, bookmark it. Always buy your Amazon crap through there. We get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, 646-257-3920, or you can IM me at Majority FM. Give us a review on iTunes, for God's sakes. Hey, did you do it before a long time ago? Do it again. I think you can leave more than one review. Pick up the app. It's a great way to turn other people on to the show. Just go to majorityapp.com. iOS or Android for your enjoyment. All right, we'll see you in a minute.